here in chapter 26, above verse number 14, Yudalid. Starting from here until the end of chapter 26, it's a portion which is called the Tochacha, the rebuke. There are two of these Tochachot, or rebukes in the Torah. One here, one in Deuteronomy. The main subject, the main theme, it's a warning what's going to happen to the Jews if you don't keep the commandments. Remember how the Parsha started. If you do keep my commandments, all the things will, this and this and this will happen. So here is the second side of it. What about if you don't? Vim lo tishmeu li. What about if you don't listen to me? Velo ta'asu et kol ha-mitzvot ha'ele. And you don't fulfill the commandments. Then it goes on to the next step. You don't listen to me, you don't fulfill the commandments. Im bechukotai tim'asu. You will be disgusted by my laws. Vim et mishpatai tiga'al nafshechem. And tigal nafshechem is also an expression of disgust, something that you don't like, something that you intensely dislike. My laws, levilti asot et kol mitzvotai, and this will lead it to not doing the mitzvot, lehafrechem et briti, to break my pact. So, the commentator of Rashi says something interesting here. See, there is an apparent lack of order here in the steps. The first step here is not listening. Im lo tishme'u, not listening. And then you don't do. Lo ta'asu et kol ha-mitzvot. And then he says, vim bechukotai tim'asu. You will be disgusted by my commandments. That means that you won't fulfill them. So Rashi says that it's not so. In verse number 15, im bechukotai tim'asu, when you will be disgusted by my laws, it doesn't mean by your keeping of the laws. Says Rashi, Moes be'acherim ho'osim. The way, you know, thank God, in our generation, that is not a major problem. But about 100 years ago, the major problem of Jews was the Jews that were leaving Judaism. Right? Jews who were abandoning. Today we have a reversal of the abandonment. But that abandonment was in large, large quantities. How did it start? It does not start by abandoning the mitzvahs. It's very difficult to find a person that in one morning, remember, we are talking about a Jewish people that was, let's say, 90% observant. I mean, throughout the generations, Jews were observant. All of a sudden, because of the, after the French Revolution, the Enlightenment, the opening up of the society, the Gentile society, all of a sudden you had like an exodus of observant Judaism. So what is the first step? A person didn't get up in the morning all of a sudden and stopped eating kosher food or stopped putting on phylacteries. That didn't happen. It was a process. It was a slow process. So the first step in the process, says Rashi, is moes be'acherim ha'osim. You become disgusted by other Jews who keep the mitzvos. You see the keeping of the mitzvos, the keeping of Judaism, as something disgusting. That's the first step. Meaning, not that you don't believe in the mitzvah. It's not an ideological step. But you are embarrassed by your fellow Jews. You're embarrassed by them. And that has been recorded, that was a major problem. Jews embarrassed by their Jewishness. Right? So yours you hid, but the other ones. So you were embarrassed to be seen with them. Because Jews are embarrassing. What is the next step? Says Rashi, Mishpatai tig'al nafshechem. Mishpatai doesn't mean my laws. Mishpatai means my decision maker, the rabbis, the sages, says Rashi. Sone hachachamim. The next step, after you're being disgusted by your fellow Jews doing a mitzvah, is that you start blaming the leaders. And you say, oh, that's it. They don't really understand what's going on in this generation, or how things are different. So that's the next step. So ne'ah chachamim. You start hating the leaders of the Jewish people. Levilti asot. Then comes the next step. And since you hate the leaders, you take on the job of leadership and you start preaching the abandonment of Judaism. Start preaching it. You start saying, well, you know, it's a, in our society, we have to, we can't continue being what we used to be. We have to adjust. This is the next step, says Rashi. Moneya et acherim me'asot. You start influencing other people to stop keeping the laws. What is the next step? It's interesting. The ideological change, the real ideological change, is the fourth step, says Rashi. Et kol mitzvotai kofer shelo tzivitim. Then comes the ideological part, which is, well, do you really think that God commanded the Jews to keep the Torah? Can be. And God won't get involved with human beings to tell them what to do. Obviously, it was our ancestors who invented the Torah. They made up the Torah. Well, if it's our ancestors who made up the Torah, why shouldn't we abandon it? I mean, they were human beings, so we are also human beings. That is the next step, which means the ideological change only comes after the first few steps, which is the embarrassment of being Jewish. That is the step. You are embarrassed by your Jewishness, and that expresses itself in your criticizing Jews who don't hide their Jewishness, that on the surface they should be like all Gentiles. And only after that you start denying the divinity, the divine source of the Torah. Lekach nemaret kol mitzvotai. That's why it says, my commandments. They deny that the commandments are mine, says God. That is the fourth step. And what is the fifth step, says Rashi? Lehafrechem et briti. Kofer be'ikar. Once he denies the fact that the mitzvot were given by God, he denies that God cares altogether what human beings do. So therefore, since God doesn't care, we have to take care of our own destiny. We can't rely on God to take care of us. So those are the seven steps, says Rashi. Hare Sheva Averos. The seven transgressions that we mentioned before, that are mentioned in the Torah, Lo Tishmu, etc., etc., eventually says, Goreret Ashniyah, the first one leads to the second one until the seventh one. You start with not studying Torah. Lo lamad. It goes over again the seven steps. First starts by not studying. You didn't study Torah. You don't study Torah, you yourself, your mitzvos are flawed because you don't know how to fulfill them. Then you see others doing mitzvahs and you become disgusted by them. Then you start hating the sages. Then you start working on other people to stop doing the mitzvahs. Then you deny the divine source of the laws, and then you deny divine providence, the existence of God or divine providence, the fact that God cares about human beings. It's interesting, there are seven steps. Okay, seven steps. Now, the number seven will be a recurrent number throughout the Torah, the rebuke. Then he goes on to say in verse number 16, Af ani eseh zot lachem. The way God reacts is called midah keneged midah, measure for measure. Depending on the type of sin that you commit, this is how the reaction of God will be. Vifkatti aleichem, I will command on you, which means I will punish you, and then there is a list of different bad things that will happen. And in verse number 17, Venatati panai bachem venifgaftem lifnei avchem, you will be attacked and destroyed by your enemies. Veradu vachem sonechem, your enemies will have dominion over you. Venastem, and you will run away, you will escape. Ve'ein rodef etchem, but nobody will be pursuing you. One of the commentaries says, this is a rebuke. It's telling you things that will happen which are supposed to be scary. Right? So, if it would say, they'll catch you, you will escape and they'll run after you and catch you. Fine, that we can understand. What's wrong with escaping, and nobody pursues you, right? Right? You become a paranoid soul. Isn't that better than being escaping and being pursued? Right? What? All right. In other words, a person who somebody pursues him, right, and he escapes. So there's always a chance that the pursuer will stop pursuing him, and then you can live in tranquility. But a person who can't discern the enemy, right, he always thinks somebody's pursuing him. He'll never reach that level of tranquility. This is the state of Jews in exile, it says. It doesn't mean that every single time that Jews will always be living in fear. Not necessarily. But there will always be a feeling that somebody's trying to destroy us. And that in itself, right? Meaning, very often it is right. And most of the times it is right. But even at those times when it's not right, we won't be able to enjoy the fruits of that tranquility. We'll always keep in the back of my mind, of our minds, the fear. That is the meaning of the statement, the Eiro of Deifetchem. You'll never be able to rest from that feeling because it will be like a paranoia. And then take a look in verse number 18. Vimad eile lo tishmeuli. And if this won't help, you still won't listen to me. Ve'yasafti li asaretchem. I'll continue punishing you. Sheva, 7 times. Here I told you 7 times. Al chatotechem, on your sin. And then he tells what will happen with the rain will stop. There'll be a drought in the land. You'll have problems. And you'll work the land and your energy will be wasted in verse number 20. And in verse number 21, again, a new word appears, which again appears 7 times in this rebuke. 7 times the word appears. Ve'im telchu imi keri. The word carry is an unusual word. Carry, what? That's how you usually translate it, but not in this case. The word carry is related to the word mikre in Hebrew. You know what mikre is? A chance, something that happens by chance. Mikre. If you will walk with me, carry, which means as if everything happens by chance, and therefore you won't listen to me because you say everything happens by random anyway. So why should I bother listening to God? He won't change things anyway. So why do things occur? By pure chance. So, again, the number 7. You'll see. Things will happen 7 times, whatever that means. But again, the number 7. We'll see right away. And it says, in verse number 23 again, and you will continue walking in this way, in carry, which means believing. Carry is an ideological state in which your behavior fits into that ideology that everything happens by chance. Nothing happens because God controls the world. Okay? Vehalachti, in verse number 24. So how will I react? Vehalachti. Af ani imachem bekeri. I will act with you exactly the way you created the ideology. Which means your ideology will be fulfilled. And the more things will happen to you, the more you will be convinced how right you are, how things always happen by chance. And therefore it will keep strengthening your wrong ideology. That will be my punishment. My punishment is that with your own ideology will destroy you. So unless you abandon it, be careful. It will lead you to destruction. And again, in verse number 24, V'ikeiti etchem gamani sheva al chatotechem. Again, the number 7. And then he tells you in verse number 25, and you will be attacked with a sword, and you will be given over in the hands of the enemies. Now, according to our tradition, each time it says that, it's referring in the future. It's a prophecy concerning another time that the Jews were given over to their enemies. And again, in verse...
Each pasuk is different by Nestor?
Definitely. Definitely. Each pasuk is something else. At least one event. At least. It could be referring to 10 events, as we are going to see. There are certain things that are recurring in Jewish history. And again in verse number 27, and if you still don't listen to me, again you will be. I told you seven times the word carry appears. And in verse number 28, again I will walk with you, and it will become more and more, deeper and deeper, that carry relationship. And then it says, verse number 30, and I will destroy your altars. Chamonechem just is a symbol of the sun. That's the Chamonechem. But there were people in many ancient nations who believed in the power of the sun, and they used to worship the sun. And the Chamonechem is that sign, the sign of the sun. Chama, you know, in Aramaic, Chama is the sun. I will destroy your idols. So, again the commentaries say, that doesn't sound so bad. Remember, everything in the Toch and the rebuke has to be bad. What's so bad about God destroying the idols? That's good. What? Yeah. Exactly, a person becomes completely lost. Meaning, if you develop trust in something, sometimes it's a person, it's a country, it's an ideology, right? I remember reading in the beginning of communism in Russia, there were secular Jews who said, this is the Messiah, this is the real Messiah. They actually believed that communism will save the world, that will be the fulfillment of the messianic prophecy, right? And all of a sudden, if that's taken away, you remain an empty shell. There is nothing left to you. Yeah, well, that's the irony of it. You know that proportionately, the Jews were strong backers of communism. I don't know if, unfortunately, I mean, it is a fact. Because, remember, communism has very unusual, sensitive goals, right? The well-being of people, justice, equality. So, Torah concepts that is somewhere embedded in the Jewish soul, right? So, if you abandon Torah and you're looking for alternatives, communism may sound like such a perfect alternative, right? But when, obviously, after a while, they were disappointed. And that disappointment was destructive because they wouldn't return to Judaism, right? So, communism was taken away from them as an idol, as a god. So, they are empty. There is no meaning to their lives. So, that is a punishment. And then, in verse number 31, "V'natati et arechem charba," your cities will be destroyed. "V'ashimoti et mikdashechem," your holy places will be destroyed. "V'lo ariah bereach nechochachem," I won't smell the pleasant smell. That's just a reference to the sacrifices. This is a reference to the second temple, obviously. That specifically is the second temple, the destruction of the second temple. Verse number 32. "V'hashimoti ani et haaretz," in the land of Israel, when you won't be around. Let me tell you the simple interpretation, and then the interpretation that what the commentaries derive from it. The word "v'hashimoti" means something which is wild, unkept, shmama. What? Desolation. Desolate. That's the word. "V'hashimoti ani et haaretz," and I will desolate the land. "Veshamemu aleha oveichem," and your enemies will be desolated on them. What does that mean? What does that mean? Exactly, which means for some reason no other nation in the world who will come to Eretz Yisrael, the Ramban says this, no other nation was able to develop a livable place in Israel. Right? What? That's what Ramban says. This is what it says. That the land alone, without Jews, will never be able to produce, to be a successful country. The land only gets along with Jews, with no one else. But on the other hand, it's a punishment. Because when you come to visit Israel, you are in exile, right? And you come to visit Israel, and Israel is settled by Gentiles. What do you see? Desolation. So it's a punishment because you love the country, and here it's desolated, destroyed, And this is what a lot of travelers, you know, there were a lot of travelers in the 17th century, 16th century, and they come and they say that they saw the land of Israel. It was desolate. It was heartbreaking what they saw. Right? That's exactly the punishment. But the reason for it is that the land of Israel without Jews can't produce. It's not satisfied. It's not happy, so to speak. Okay, then let's verse number 34. Eventually, only after the land of Israel will make up for the transgressed Shabbatot. Now, Shabbatot doesn't necessarily mean the day of Shabbat. It also includes the Shemitah year, the seventh year, the sabbatical year. Kol imei ha-shama, v'atem be'eretz eichem. For as many times as you transgress the law of the sabbatical year, right? That is the amount of years you'll have to stay, at least, in exile. And that's what came out. The 70 years comes out. Those were the 70...
The first exile,
right. This is a reference to the first exile for 70 years, which represents for the 70 Shemitot, the 70 sabbatical years that the Jews didn't keep properly. This is what it says in verse number 35. Kol yemei hashama tishbot. This is why the land will have to rest while being desolated. Et asher lo shavta, because of those sabbatical years that it did not rest, b'shavtoteichem b'shivtechem aleihem, when you were supposed to keep the Shabbat and you were there. And you didn't keep it, so now the land has to rest because you didn't allow it to rest. Now, in verse number 37, it tells again something which will be one of the signs of exile, of destruction. Vekashlu ish be'achiv. It's not only that we will have enemies from the outside. Even when we don't have enemies from the outside, people will will stumble over each other. Right? That's a metaphor. For what? For the lack of unity. Meaning, at least if we would be united in exile, then that would be a way back, a beginning of a rectification of our flaws. But it will be the other way around. V'kashluish b'achiv, k'mipnei cherev. It's as if we had a sword. Of course, our sword, our tongues, right? K'mipnei cherev, as if it would be a sword. V'rodei fine, even though there's nobody pursuing you, but still, it's an inner falling apart of the unity. So therefore, v'lo tiyeh lachem tkuma lifnei avechem. When the Jews are split, they can't fight against the enemies. They have to be united. And then, what is the next step? Verse number 38. Va'avadatem bagoyim. A lot of you will be lost among the Gentiles. Right? Ve'achla etchem eretz ovechem. And you will be swallowed by the land of your enemies. And in verse number 40. Ve'hitvadu et avonam. And it will come a point that you'll start recognizing your faults. And you'll admit, yes, we haven't kept our side of the deal. Vet avon avotam, and the sins of our forefathers, bema'alam asher ma'alubi, because of the transgressions that they did against me, v'af asher alchoim mibekeri. They will admit, they will recognize their sins. So what happens once they recognize their sins? Now what do you expect? What should be the next verse? They finally recognize their sins. So what should he say next verse? And then I'll accept their tshuva, right? No. Verse number 41. Afani elech imachem bekeri. So I'll continue punishing you. What do you mean? But what do you want more? We are admitting. We admit it's our fault. Right? So the commentaries say, no. You see, you didn't admit that it's your fault. You admit that there is something wrong with you. But who do you blame it on? Vet avon avotam. Who do you blame it on? It's not our fault. That's the way Jews were trained, you know, from the ancient Jews already. They established a certain pattern. We can't escape it, but it's not our fault, right? So you admit that there is something wrong with your behavior, but you say, well, but it's not our fault. It's, you know, our forefathers. It's them. That is not enough tshuva. When you take on responsibility, but you put it on somebody else, you say, you recognize your flaws, but you don't take responsibility for them, that is not real tshuva. And then in verse number 42, Vezacharti et Briti Yaakov. That's already towards the end of the talk of the rebuke. I will remember my pact with Jacob, Vaf et Briti Yitzchak, and my pact with Isaac, Vaf et Briti Abraham, and my pact with Abraham. Very strange. What's strange? Yaakov first. Oh, there's something else. The reversal of the order. Even, no, after is even. Even as far as Abram I'll go. Even as far as Abram. But I'll start with Jacob. Why not start with Abram? Usually, you the order of the patriarchs is Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. So why do we reverse it? That's one interesting fact. And there's another interesting fact that you mentioned. The extra vav in the word Yaakov. You can look most places. Yaakov, almost all places, Yaakov is spelled Yud, Ayin, Kuf, Bet. No vav. Yaakov, there's an extra vav here. Right? So those are the two problems. So in Rashi's commentary, Rashi says something which obviously he means it as an answer to the question, why there is a vav in Yaakov? But instead of an answer, it just adds to the question. Rashi says, you know why there is a vav in Yaakov? Well, he says, there are five times throughout the Bible that the word Yaakov is spelled with a vav. Five times. But it's okay, he says, because, you know, the name of Elijah the prophet in Hebrew, there are two ways, either Eliyahu or Eliyah. In a few places it's spelled Aleph, Lamed, Yud, Hey, Eliyah Hanavi. Right? So there are five places where Eliyahu is missing a vav. So here's your answer. Do you know why Yaakov is spelled with a vav? Because Eliyahu is spelled without five times, so this is why they have to go somewhere. So, what? So, what does he mean? What does it mean? Obviously, he means it as an answer, of course, but he just adds to the question. What is it all about? So, let me tell you what the commentaries say here. I will tell you what is the meaning of the letter Vav altogether, and what is the connection between Yaakov and Eliyahu, right? What is the connection between Yaakov and Eliyahu? And why they are reversed, right? Why do we start with Yaakov? It says in the commentaries the following idea. Obviously, we are going towards the end of the exile, when God starts to remember the merits of our forefathers. That's already good. So, it says the following. Do you know who is the announcer of the final redemption? Eliyahu. Eliyahu. It says Eliyahu. Eliyahu is the announcer. Now, why is he the announcer? Why is he the announcer? Why specifically Elijah? Why specifically Eliyahu? What is there about Eliyahu and Navi's life? Right? So you say, he never died, which means he lives in some kind of a level which is called not dying, whatever that means. Well, so let God choose a living person. Why does he need someone who is at that level of never dying? Right? Number one. Number two, we have other traditions of people never experiencing death. He wasn't the only one. We have others. In our tradition, we have other ones. Benjamin, it does say in certain what? Hano. There were others. But why? So why Elijah? Why Eliyahu Navi? So it says the following. There is a tradition which says that Pinchas ze Eliyahu, that Eliyahu who according to our tradition never dies and always comes to visit us on Passover night and we always give him a nice cup, that Eliyahu is Pinchas. Now, Pinchas did something which makes him a hero. What is it that he did? What? Pinchas?
Which?
Stop the plague. Right. Exactly. By killing the Jewish men from the era of the tribe of Shimon and the Gentile princess. Right? Because that union was causing the Magay for the plague and he killed them. And at that time, it wasn't clear whether what he did was right or what he did was wrong. Because usually we follow the concept of due process of the law. We bring people to court. There are a few exceptions. And the question is this one of the exceptions? Or isn't it one of the exceptions?
It was a sexual act.
You're right. So we say, yes, this is an exception. And he had every right in the world to do it. Who testified that he had that right? God himself. Right? It says right afterwards, God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, he did the right thing, right? And I am giving him a pact, a new pact. Remember what it says there? Et briti shalom, it says. The pact of shalom. But the word shalom is not spelled with a normal vav there. There is either a yud or a split vav, depending on the text that you have. But it's not a regular vav. Now, we say, what's so special about Eliyahu, about Pinchas, right? Sticking up for God, so to speak. It's described as taking up the honor of God. By the way, it says the same expression concerning Eliyahu Anavi. He also took up the honor of God. So this is where the tradition comes. It's the same person. What does it mean, killing a Jew who has relations with a Gentile? It says in the Gemara that our forefather Abraham defends every Jew who is brought into the purgatory, but with some exceptions. A Jew who is not circumcised. Because if he's not circumcised, he goes against the pact of Abraham, so he doesn't defend him. And who else? The man who lives with a Gentile. What is the connection between the two? I mean, living with a Gentile is not the worst sin in the world. There are worse sins. So why specifically this sin? Other sins, if he did something much worse, that Abraham will defend him. But if he is married to a Gentile, that Abraham won't defend him. Why not? Because being married to a Gentile is cutting off the continuity of the Jewish people. Remember, Brit Milah, circumcision represents the continuity of the Jewish people. This is why it's on the reproductive organ, because it represents the eternal continuity of the guaranteed continuity of the Jewish people. God made a seal, right? That is the Brit Milah, so to speak, that shows that God guaranteed the continuity of the Jews forever. And that's Abraham. Abraham made that pact with God. When a Jew marries the Gentile woman, that is an act that goes against the continuity, because the children will be what?
Gentile.
So it cuts off. This is why anyone who does something to cut off the continuity of the Jewish people, Abraham doesn't defend. Okay. So what does Pinchas represent when he kills the Jewish man and the Gentile woman? He is the one that guarantees the continuity. Now, it's not surprising then at all that every time there is a tradition that at every circumcision, who comes to visit? It says, you prepare a chair for Elijah. Where does that come from? What is the idea? Why by Elijah? Why not Moshe Rabbeinu? Because that's what he represents. He represents the continuity because he fought. He gave his life for the continuity. So the Brit Milah, which represents the continuity, is honored by the visit of Eliyahu Navi. Okay, now. But continuity for the sake of continuity is meaningless. Why is there a need for Jewish continuity? In order to fulfill a goal, right? What is the goal of Jewish continuity? That the Jews should fulfill their job in the world. You know, when will that be, that the Jews will fulfill their job in the world? Their job of teachers of the world, the light unto the nations, has to be fulfilled. Where, what do we call that point in time which is the fulfillment of Jewish continuity? Messianic era, obviously. So it's not a coincidence at all. So who brings the Messianic era? Who announces the Messianic era? Elijah. You know, it's here. I fulfilled my job. Yes, it came to a conclusion, to a fruition, the continuity. It's not a waste of energy. Yes, it came. So that's why he announces. Now, this is a verse at the end of the prophet Malachi, right? Here I'm sending Elijah, right? And through Elijah, it says in the prophet Malachi, Veheishiv lev avot al banim, the gaps among the generations will be closed, will be bridged. Which means that only at the end of days, what we call the Messianic era, will there be a union among generations. Why? Because Exile brings about gaps between generations. That's the nature of exile. So once exile is over, we will find the common thread throughout the generations that will unite the generation. Why are there gaps among generations? Because each generation has its own value, its own ideology. But if we would have an overwhelming belief that would go through all generations, that would be the joining of all generations. So in reality, the Messianic era is that point in time when all generations of the past will finally be united. That's Veheishiv Leivavot Al Banim Vel Benim Al Banavata. How? Through the children. That's what it says. Let's say also a Mishnah in Mesechet Sota that one of the characteristics of the Messianic era is that the children, right, will create their own ideology. They won't be bound by the ideology of the parents. Comes out that the Messianic era will be brought about by the youth, by the young generation, and through them it will go backwards to the older generation, which means that the Geula will start backwards. Velev banim alavotam. In other words, they will awaken their parents, and the parents will both go backwards to the generation before, and little by little, the whole of Jewish history will finally be united. Right? It will make sense. It will come to fruition. Okay? So there is a reversal. Instead of the ancestors influencing the behavior of the children, it will be the other way around. The children will change history. They'll put history in the right place. Okay? Now, comes out according to this, that is the job of Elijah, the uniting of the generations. You know which letter in the Hebrew alphabet represents union? Chibur. Vov. The Vov is called Vov. The letter Vov, it even looks like a hook. A hook, the symbol of the hook is union, connection, right? But it's called the word Vov. Ani ve'ata. What is the Vav? Vav ha-chibur. The letter Vav always unites, right? The letter Vav always represents uniting, joining, okay? Now, so that's the job of Eliyahu, right? The joining, right? So it says, but five times the letter Vav, right, is not there, right? It's not there. So I just want to read to you the Rashi here, just to hear it clearly. I'm reading from verse number 42. Bachamisha mekomot nichtav male. In five places, Yaakov is written with a vav. Ve'eliyahu chaser bachamisha mekomot. Why? Yaakov natal ot mishmo shel Eliyahu. Yaakov insisted in taking the vav from Eliyahu. Why? A ravon, a guarantee. You hear the metaphor. He took the vav from Eliyahu and says, oh, no, I want to keep that vav. I want to make sure that what? A ravon, it's a guarantee. Sheyavo, with the vav, he will come and he will announce geulat banav, vivaser geulat banav. And he will announce the redemption of the children. So what comes out according to this? That Yaakov, which represents the Jewish people, remember, Abraham had Ishmael, Isaac had Esau. Yaakov is the first 100% Jew, right? Because he, mitatosh lema, he already has 12 Jewish children. So Yaakov represents the totality of the Jewish people, the completion of the Jewish people. But what will be the chances of survival? He needs a guarantee of survival. Well, when the Vov will appear, which means the connections, that will be the time of the Geula. So the fact that the Vov of Eliyahu is transferred to Yaakov just represents the sign of the guaranteed connection. Okay? So, this is why Yaakov is holding the guarantee, the Vov, so to speak, to make sure that history reaches a goal. Do you understand this idea? The concept of the Vov is that it's not going to be a trip to nowhere. Jews will beget Jews, will beget Jews, until what? Until the world will disappear. No, that's not the way it is. There is something that will connect Jewish history. There will be a Vav. That's what Yaakov represents. And why is it backwards? Because the process is backwards. The process of the Geula is not from Avram, Yitzchok, and Yaakov. It's the other way around. It will be awakened by the last generation, and they will start the joining process backwards to Yaakov Avinu, Vov, to Yaakov Avinu, and Yaakov, of course, to Yitzchok, and Yitzchok to Avram, which means that it's a hint that the process will be backwards, okay? So this is what the commentaries say concerning the meaning of the letter Vov. And, what? This is the meaning of the word Tshuva. Returning to the source, going backwards. And we can't finish the parsha without the famous Meshech Chochmah, which I say over every year. In verse number 44, again, something which sounds like part of the rebuke. Ve'av gamzot, in spite of everything, biotam beretz ovem, when you'll be in the land of your enemies, lo me'astem ve'lo ge'altem l'chalotom, I will not allow you to be destroyed. Right. Now, does that sound like a rebuke or sounds like a blessing? Sounds like a blessing, of course. So the famous question is, so why is it part of the rebuke? Right. I won't allow you to be destroyed. Be careful. I won't allow you to be destroyed, to disappear. Right? Lechalotam. So that's where the Meshech Chochma comes and says, well, it is a punishment. Why? Because very often Jews want to abandon their Judaism. They want that as a solution to their anti-Semitism. Abandon their Judaism. So for you it would be a blessing if I would allow you to do it. But I won't. If you forget that you are Jewish, the Gentiles will remind you that you are Jewish, he says. That's what he says. So this is why it's a punishment. You'll want to abandon your Judaism. So the Gentiles will come and they will remind you. But the shocking part of the Meshech Chochmah is what it says. The Meshech Chochmah was written second part of the 19th century. When he was a young man, Reb Meir Simcha Cohen, the Or Sameach, he wrote Meshech Chochmah and Torah when he was a young man. And he says there, and therefore, it says, this is part of Jewish history. You know, Jews come to a new culture. They want to adjust to the new culture, and they give up their Judaism. And then they think they are part of the culture. All of a sudden, the Gentiles remind them, no, you are not. Leave. Right? He says, and now there are Jews who believe that Berlin is Jerusalem, he says. Berlin is Jerusalem. And I was German Jews who say, well, our capital is Berlin, not Jerusalem. Now, we are Germans. We are good Germans. We are not, you know, Jews, that's our religion, but we are really German. So he says, oh, there's a tremendous danger, he says, that a storm will come to remind them that they are not Germans, that they are Jewish. That's what he wrote at the end of the 19th century. Where he says, and here it says, this is where it says, here it says, that if you want to forget that you are Jewish, then the Gentiles have to remind you. That's always painful. If you yourself remember, then it's smooth, easy. But when the Gentiles have to remind you, that's very painful. It's better not, you know, be careful. Don't do it. So this is why it's a rebuke. This is why it's a punishment. Okay. Oh, down here. Oh, right, right. Good that you reminded me. Now, the whole idea of the Torah, of the rebuke, is the belief that we are controlled by forces of nature and nothing beyond the forces of nature. Now, we know that the number seven always represents the forces of nature. The goal is to break out of the number seven and to believe in a number eight. That's why Brit Milah, by the way, Brit Milah is on the eighth day because it breaks out from the laws of nature. If you are not able to be convinced of that, if you live under the ideology that you are completely controlled by the number seven, which means nothing else exists but the laws of nature, the laws of history, and you are just part of that big cycle of nature, then you will never be able to do tshuva. I mean, the danger is being a slave to the number seven. Our goal is to break out of the number seven. Right? This is why the Torah is given after the 7 times 7, the 49 days, which is the 7 times 7. It's only the 50th day. Okay? So this is the idea of the Torah. The Torah is be careful. Don't become a slave to the number seven.